This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Sometimes I get these emails from people, oh, I'm 23 years old, and I don't know what my passion is in life. Is it too late for me? Am I a failure? And that's just so ridiculous. First off, maybe you're not really meant. It's not like we were born and we're so different from the other trillion species on this planet that we have this God-given passion. Each one of us is this unique fingerprint or snowflake or whatever that is meant to have this special purpose in the world. We're not, it's much more important to just be relaxed and calm and be good to the people around you than have this overriding purpose. Jay is rolling. So I decided to do an episode about how to find your passion. And when we were discussing this, it was Jay, audio engineer extraordinaire, Robin, my wife, we were talking about this. And Robin was mentioning how, by the way, hello, Robin, my
hello.
Wife. we were talking about, at first you were mentioning how, yeah, kids want to know how to find their passion. And that's true. But I also said that even many people in their 50s who have been commuting to work for 30 straight years, sometimes they want a life change, or sometimes they get laid off, or sometimes something drastic that happens that forces them to make, you know, these life-changing decisions. People even in their 50s want to find out what their passion is and how to explore it, how to learn it, how to monetize it. And Jay said, yeah, that's true too. Old people want to find their passions. And I'm like, Jay, old people, I'm 52 years old now. So it's not like I'm walking around in a walker or anything. Like, but yeah, I find my new passions all the time, even in the late great 50s that I'm in. I'm moments from death of old age, and I still want to do things I'm passionate about. Jay's trying hard not to laugh because he's in charge of the audio, but we'll make him laugh. Meanwhile, sometimes I get these emails from people, oh, I'm 23 years old and I don't know what my passion is in life. Is it too late for me? Am I a failure? And that's just so ridiculous. First off, maybe you're not really meant. It's not like we were born and we're so different from the other trillion species on this planet that we have this God-given passion. Each one of us is this unique fingerprint or snowflake or whatever that is meant to have this special purpose in the world. We're not, it's much more important to just be relaxed and calm and be good to the people around you than have this overriding purpose. Like your purpose is to, you know, save the Amazon forest. If that's what you're good at and you could do it, then great. But don't be stressed if you don't have this amazing purpose or you don't know what it is right away. I'll tell you about a couple of times I have found different things I'm passionate about. And by the way, it's changed so much for me. Like when I was really young, I was passionate about, I wanted to be a professor of computer science. Then I wanted to be a writer of novels. I remember I actually was going to graduate school for computer science, and I was away for the summer. I was with a bunch of friends, and I saw one friend of mine who had the classic like look of a writer, and he was always like writing in coffee shops. And this was around 1990. This girl that I had a crush on fell for him because she liked that whole writer thing. And suddenly, this is it. This is why I suddenly became really passionate about writing. So I started reading every novel I could get my hands on. Everyone was talking about all these. I didn't take a single English course in my entire college career, and I knew nothing about any great works of literature. But I started reading constantly. I started writing every day. I started writing 3,000 words a day. I started doing this to the detriment of all my computer science classes. So within a year, I got thrown out of graduate school. There was many reasons, but probably the biggest one was that I was writing every day. And I wrote four novels, and I wrote dozens and dozens of short stories. And I'd love to find these novels, but they're all gone now somehow. I don't know where they were all saved online at some computer that doesn't exist anymore. And nothing got published. Not a single word I wrote got published. And this is 3,000 words a day, 365 days a year for at least, I did that until I moved to New York City. I still continue writing every day, but not 3,000 words a day. But so I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of words that was. But everything I wrote, I tried to get published. I would send out to publishers and agents, and for the short stories I was writing, I would send out to magazines. Not only did nobody publish anything, my great classics, like, let me see if I can remember one of the titles. One of the titles was The Prostitute, The Poor Novelist, I can't even remember the title of this classic book that I wrote. Anyway, it was a novel that I wrote in an entire 3 days, and that didn't get published. Another one was, I called it The Book of Orpheus, which is such a pretentious title. That didn't get published. That was my first one. Then I wrote a historical novel about King David. I called that The Book of David, being very original. It was right after I wrote The Book of Orpheus. That one didn't get published. Then I wrote, I can't remember. I think I wrote How to Win at Video Games. That was the name of a novella, and that didn't get published. So here's what I did. I chose myself, even in 1994, I did this. I printed everything up on it's almost the size of a mini pad. Like it was supposed to fit in the palm of your hand, and you could read it in one direction and then turn it upside down and read it in the other direction. So I printed that up on the copy machine at my work. I'd already been thrown out of graduate school, and I was working as a computer programmer, but I wrote the program in the first week, and then I kept telling everybody, oh, it's really hard, I'm still working on it, and I never had to do any programming again. I just focused on writing, and I printed up like a couple hundred copies of this mini book of a bunch of my short stories and two novellas, and I went to every bookstore in town. This was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I went to every bookstore in town, and I let them sell my little booklet for 25 cents. So that was my first self-published booklet. I think the overall booklet was called How I Saved the World from Mutual Assured Destruction, and that was the novella that with that title. You'd read one direction, then you turn it upside down, and you'd read How to Win at Video Games in the other direction. And I sold out about 80 copies of that book for 25 cents a copy. I put my phone number in the back of the book. One person called me, and we had I don't remember the conversation at all, but that was my first self-published book. And then I decided, you know what? I need connections. And so I was watching TV. Whenever I wasn't writing, I was usually watching TV, and I was obsessed with both MTV and HBO. And so I figured I want to work at HBO. And I applied for a job there. And I also applied for a job at JP Morgan, the bank. JP Morgan offered me a job for $80,000 a year salary, which would have, for me at the time, I was making $27,600 a year as a computer programmer. So I would have gone from $27,000 and change to $80,000 a year. HBO also offered me a job. They offered me $40,000, half of JP Morgan. I took the HBO job because I was very serious about my quote unquote passion, which was writing. I thought I could go to HBO as a computer programmer. And then once I was in the big city, magic would happen. And the next thing you know, I would have a TV show on HBO and I'd write all the novels I want and everything would get published and it would be amazing. It didn't work out that way. I ended up, one thing led to another. I got obsessed with doing a TV show for HBO. I had a big attempt at that. That's another story. Then I tried another TV show. I'll talk about that for a second. I had a friend of mine who was very funny. She was a woman. That's why I use the pronoun she. And I told her, put an ad in the paper and say, you want to go on a blind date. And at the time, people put ads in newspapers, not like now. This was 1995. And so I said, put an ad in the paper, or 1996, put an ad in the paper and say you want to go on a blind date. And so 100 people responded and she picked the location for the date. Now, what we did was a couple hours before her big date, we wired up the whole restaurant. We've had video cameras everywhere. We had audio, everywhere. We were sitting on either side of the table she was at, and we had audio there. And we videotaped the entire date. The date didn't know. We called this blind date. And just insane things were happening. We videotaped two of these so-called episodes. And on one of them, the entire date, the guy was wondering whether he was, and he was confiding in her, he was trying to figure out if he was straight or gay. So he was kind of dating both sides, men and women, to sort of figure it out. And then the next episode, the guy actually got a phone call from his wife in the middle of the date. And then he still continued the date, and we had a release form for him to sign at the end. He wouldn't sign the release form until Amy, my friend, would agree to have sex with him, which she didn't agree, so I think. And then we videotaped it, we pitched it to HBO, everybody loved it, but then, as became common, whenever I pitched a TV show, nobody ever called me back ever again. And I even worked at HBO, so that was frustrating. But then I got obsessed with being an entrepreneur, then I got obsessed with being an investor, then I got obsessed with writing again and podcasting, playing poker. I became so obsessed with poker, I played it for 365 days straight, including the day my oldest child was born. I was there for the birth, but then left afterwards to play poker. So passions change. But one thing I realize, if you want to find your passion, there's a couple of techniques I realize. One is figure out what you were passionate about at age 13 or 12, kind of this critical age, right in between childhood, puberty, adulthood. Figure out what you were interested in, what you were passionate about then, and see how it aged. So for instance, if you were interested in sports, but now you're this, overweight, out of shape guy or lady in her 40s or 50s, and obviously you're not going to be a professional athlete, maybe your passion aged from sports into fantasy sports, and you could start a fantasy sports league or bet on it or write a blog about it. I pick that as an example because Matthew Berry, one of the first guests on my podcast in 2014, he went from being a Hollywood screenwriter to hating it, to switching his interest, to going back to sports. He got obsessed with fantasy sports. He started blogging about it. And now he's the number one or the only anchor ESPN has ever hired for fantasy sports. And even when I walk down the street with this guy, people recognize him and thank him for all his fantasy sports picks and so on. So he was a great example of seeing how his passion aged. I know for myself, I was always interested in writing, and my passion aged. So I ended up not writing novels, but I wrote, a whole bunch of nonfiction books about a variety of subjects. Another thing I was always interested in, even as a kid, was investing. And then I lost interest in it, but back in my 30s, I became interested and obsessed in it again. So again, a lot of the things I became interested in as an adult, later on, I realized, they've aged in different ways with me, and I became interested in the ways in which they aged. So for another thing, I always used to interview people. When I was in sixth grade, I was really interested in politics. So what I would do is I would call up a whole bunch of politicians. I called up from the president of the United States on down. I called up every politician I could think of. I remember I spoke to Senator Bill Bradley, who was the senator from New Jersey at the time. I spoke to this guy, Jim Wright, who was a congressman who became the Speaker of the House. I spoke to Rex Stoughton, who was the chief usher of the White House. I couldn't get a hold of President Jimmy Carter, who was the president at the time, but I spoke to the chief usher. I spoke to all these governors, senators, congressmen. I visited, and how did I speak to them? I called them up and I basically said, I'm writing a column for my local newspaper. It was called The Home News, my local newspaper. And would they speak to this kid? I was 12 years old. Would they speak to me? And at one point, the editor-in-chief of The Home News actually called me, and I had never spoken to this guy before, and I had nothing to do with them, period. And he said to me, you can't say you're writing a column for The Home News. You're not. There are people with PhDs trying to write columns for our newspaper. You're a 12-year-old kid. You can't say, you can't call up the president of the United States and say you're writing a column for the Home News. But he said, I'll give you a tour of the Home News, which he did. And it was fun. And I kept calling people and saying that anyway, all my interviews were published in a column and in a big article in another newspaper. And I got $75 for it, my first paying gig. It was the South Brunswick Central Post. But that is the first time I started interviewing, and it was a lot of fun. How did that passion age? Well, of course, it aged by me eventually doing a podcast, I don't know, 33 years later. So you'll if you look back, you'll find your passions age and might intersect with things you're interested in now. Another way to find your passion is go to the bookstore. Walk around at the different sections. Is there any section where you would feel comfortable reading all of the books in that section? And if it is, chances are there's probably some way to monetize or explore that interest. You know, look at someone like I've had recently on the podcast, Dan Carlin, who has his own podcast, Hardcore History, which I think actually gets the most downloads per episode of any podcast in the world right now. And Dan Carlin's not a historian, but he's been fascinated since he was a little kid about history. And he was always talking to his family about all these weird historical things and interests and different perspectives than you read in the usual history textbooks. And finally, his mother-in-law, as he put it, was so sick of him telling all these stories around the dinner table. She said, why don't you start a podcast? And he said, well, I'm not a historian. I can't do it. And then it was like a light sort of appeared in his head, and he realized nothing can stop him from starting his own podcast and telling the history stories that are not in our usual, not the stories usually told in our history textbooks. And he started his own history podcast. Now he makes a living essentially being a historian, although as he constantly reminded me in our podcast, he's not a historian. And yet his history episodes are more, I don't know, more interesting to me than any history textbook has ever been. So there's so many examples out there of people who kind of reinvent themselves by sort of being reinvigorated by finding out what their new passions are. And that's, and again, at any point, you can find a passion, you can explore it, and you could potentially monetize it like Dan Carlin does it with his podcast. I've done it throughout my life by either investing or starting a company. Like I started several companies around my interest in investing. I started a company around my interest in technology. I started a podcast. I've now written books that have been profitable for me. And I don't know. What do you, I'm doing an experiment here too. I'm doing a podcast where I tell a story. Any other stories, Robin, or that you know of that I could tell, or I know your interest is you're reading books constantly about parenting, and right. We're planning on doing episodes about that because between us we have 5 kids, and you know I see you all the time. You're essentially obsessed with parenting, which I'm not, and. You could just look at my kids and as an example of that. And no. I'm being hard on my kids. But any other stories or?
I think that, you know, it's like with our kids at their ages, it's a question about what is their passion because we want them to be happy. So I've sort of been focusing on that.
When you were a kid, did you have a passion?
And I was just thinking about that. Horses.
Yeah, you were in rodeos. How old were you when you first entered into a rodeo?
High school, so probably my freshman year.
And so did you like practice? How often did you go, like, I don't know, what do you call it? Practice.
I rode every day.
Horse practice. You went every day horseback riding?
Yes, that's just what I did.
And what would you practice, like jumping over the things?
I did, but my mother did not want me to do that. I was not allowed to do that, but I loved it.
You did it anyway.
I did it anyway.
Who cares about your mom? and then did you practice, like, I've seen you do all these, like, rope tricks. Did you practice those?
Yeah, I did.
Did you have, like, a tutor for those?
No, I didn't have a tutor. I had my mother, who was professional rodeo, so she taught me. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's one of the first women in PRCA.
What's the PRCA?
Professional Rodeo Association.
What's the C?
Professional Rodeo.
And cowboy or cowgirl?
And yeah, I think so.
I don't know.
And so, I'll have to look at that.
And so, okay, so you had a passion and you were interested in. What else were you passionate about as a kid?
Well, let's see. much. I loved art, and that was something that I carried through because I became a hairstylist and trained, you know, in doing color. So that was my, I guess, hair was the muse that I used.
Well, now also with art, I see you do art all over this house that we live in. So I had a house or an apartment in New York City with basically no objects in it. I was just coming off of this 2.5 year period where I threw away all my possessions and was living in Airbnbs. Then I got an apartment, had nothing in it. You moved in, and suddenly one day I left, there was nothing in it. I came back and I thought I was in the wrong apartment. There was stuff everywhere. There was like art from like every country in the world. There was your art, and you even been making art recently. Like you did that thing with the fabric that where you could, if you rub your hand on it, you could make all sorts of shapes and colors and drawings, and then you frame that, and now people, whenever they come over our house, they get like obsessed with these with these things. So you're still doing your passion has aged with you in the venerable years of the 50s, as Jay would put it. You're an old woman now.
So it's a creative. I've always been a creative person. So I think a lot of my creativity has been with how to manage kids. So that's sort of where a lot of my energy...
Like hang them upside down outside of that window. What do you mean? What do you mean your creativity is how to manage kids? Well, what creative thing would you do managing your kids?
Well, you have to be creative and figure out, because each one of them, you know, is different. So you have to be able to, you know, manage that. And, well, and you have to come up with something unique for each one of them and how to deal with all the issues that arise.
But what's an example?
Well, let's see. So with the girls, you know, boys, boy problems, problems with their friends.
And I've seen you deal with that. Like every situation, it's like they have a new, particularly girls, and I have two daughters, you have two daughters. So we both see this, and it's as if they have a new situation every single day with friends, particularly after puberty, with friends, boyfriends. Somebody was talking about somebody else, but then they heard the other person talking about it, and now that everybody, all of them are upset, and they're crying, not always crying, but, and you...
It seems to happen all at once, too, because they have the same cycle, so it's like, oh.
Actually, you might know this, but I don't. Do all four of our girls, are their cycles synced, particularly when they're all living under the same roof?
Well, if they live with us all together, yes. Typically that happens, I think.
Did that happen? Do you know if it happened?
I don't know if that happened because I'm not keeping track of that. But there are apps for that now, which I just found out about, which was interesting, to keep, you know, their cycle. So I was like, wow, I need that so that I know when I can approach them.
So
without getting
you don't even want to deal with your own daughters having PMS. So that explains a lot. But I'll tell you the craziest thing I ever had was passionately interested in. This was around like eighth grade, and I got passionately interested in meditation. And I didn't want to tell my parents because I thought it was against their religion, so I was ashamed to tell them. But I would skip school and as much as possible, and there was this field in back of my house. I would run across this field, this farmer's field, and then this bus went straight from the highway in back of that field to New York City. I go into New York City, and there was this kind of cultish meditation group, and I would just sit and meditate with them all day. And then at night I would meditate, and I in the morning I set my alarm for 4:45 a.m. and I would meditate for like an hour. I don't know. I think I thought I was going to get like psychic powers from this. That was like my initial goal. And I did this for about 3 years, this obsession. But for me also at age into a kind of as an adult, I don't always meditate, but I had it my own kind of more mature meditation practice than all the BS that's constantly taught. In, you know, I kind of researched it enough as a kid, and then even later that I have my own version of a meditation practice as opposed to falling for any of the garbage that people, oh, pay $5,000 to get your mantra. And by the way, mm-hmm. it's secretly the same. Don't tell your mantra to anyone because it happens to be the same mantra we're telling every single other person that we're charging $5,000 for. There's so much BS out there in kind of this cultish self-help mm-hmm. BS stuff. But since I had been doing, since I was a kid, I had a more, you know, mature way of looking at it. I don't monetize my interest in this at all, but it's something that became much more easily a life practice for me rather than being fooled into something else like so many people are.
Was that before puberty or after that you got into
it? That was right after puberty. I know that because I literally thought I would start meditating and have psychic powers and could read girls. Why did I want to have psychic powers? So I could read girls' minds to see if they liked me or not. But it was pretty, I didn't need psychic powers to determine that. It turned out none of them liked me. Like I remember even in eighth grade, I remember one time, I don't know why we were learning this, but in gym, that we were learning square dancing. Why would they teach square dancing to a bunch of Jews in gym in the Northeast? I have no idea. But I remember no girl wanted to physically touch me. And so they would all whisper to each other, you don't have, just hold your hand like 3 inches from his. You don't have to actually touch him. Just have the motion as if you're touching him. No girl liked me. One time, this was in 10th grade, I asked a girl out and literally she started immediately running. She started running as fast as possible away from me. Another time I asked a girl out, she also ran, but also yelled at the same time, not in a million years, which I viewed as an ounce of hope that maybe in a million, she didn't rule it out completely. She said maybe in a million years, something like that. So I was very optimistic, aww. But meditation certainly did not help me get a girlfriend.
I think though, with what you did with your meditation, it was a coping mechanism that you used through your life and you still use it, which I think is really very healthy.
What do you mean by coping mechanism?
Well, because when you go through puberty and you know, some people turn to drugs or alcohol or something. And it's a time when I think you actually go through puberty that you find what your coping mechanism is. So for instance, mine was riding horses all the time. So that was my way of being alone or just with my horse, peace. And now when I go ride a horse, I can smell it. I love the stables. I love the way everything smells and it calms me down.
So when you were a little kid and so this was after puberty and you know, your mom was, I know your mom was strict in other ways. You probably weren't allowed to have a boyfriend or whatever. Or at least maybe you were, maybe you had constant boyfriends, but you never told me about it. But am I right in saying that your mom was strict and wouldn't
let you? Well, very strict, right. I couldn't go out on a date.
Right. So this was maybe like an escape, not only an escape thing, but let me ask you a question. Is it true girls often experience their first orgasm while riding a horse? Did you ever get excited while riding a horse? That's the way you're bouncing up and down.
No.
All right. I was just asking. I figured the podcast like a truth. It's like a truth serum. Yeah, everybody has to answer the truth. It's like when Scott was on, our friend Scott Cohen was on the podcast and he was talking about this company he was involved in and helped start, you know, move forward, which was a erectile dysfunction drug. And I was able to ask him, well, did you ever use it?
Yeah.
And he had to answer the truth, which was yes, he tried it out. But so I had to ask you that. But I remember one time I think a lot of times passions and interests, particularly as a kid, are escape mechanisms because you're not able to fully indulge in what you might be interested in socially. You know, I found that people who were like the most social in high school, they didn't necessarily have these weird outside interests. And like I had, you know, like there was one point, so here I was in the 80s, this little kid, again, white, Jewish, Northeastern kid, and I got obsessed with breakdancing. And I thought maybe, A, I loved it as an art form. I just thought it was so interesting to watch. And B, I thought I would meet girls this way, which of course did not happen as usual. I didn't meet any girls throughout all of high school, but I got really obsessed with becoming a good breakdancer. So I found some kids who would give me lessons. and I gave them like $10 and they gave me lessons for an entire summer. And then I found other friends near my hometown where we would just hang out and practice all day. And I got obsessed with it. And again, it doesn't really age well, particularly for me. Like, it's not like I'm ever going to do it professionally, but some days I do it for exercise. I definitely break dance every single day, but now just for exercise. It's the main way I get exercise.
Yeah, I do too. I think when I was in high school, you know,
I would not break dance,
but I'd dance just in front of the mirror or something, you know, and I still do that when I'm stressed or if I want to just relax, I'll just dance. It's very meditative. I think all these things, the coping mechanisms is a form of meditation. So it's good to pick up those sort of good habits when you're young, and you want to create that environment for your kids during that time.
One thing I always think is important is once you have a passion and that something you're interested in, you know, you have two choices. One is you ignore it because it's not like the cool thing to do, or you don't think it'll, if you're a kid, you don't think it'll get you into college, or if you're an adult, you don't think there's any money there. Both of those ideas are wrong, by the way, but often people will avoid their passions because they're afraid of something. And the other things, you could do it, but not try to learn, not try to be better at it. Like, you could have been interested in horseback riding, but never really wanted to get better, but you chose to learn how to get better and eventually, you know, kind of measure yourself by performing in rodeos and so on. And, you know, so like one interest of mine, kind of right after the breakdancing one, was I knew the rules to chess, but I wasn't a chess player. And so I was 16 going on 17, and the chess club in my school, they were missing a player. They were doing an away game in some town, a couple of towns away. They were missing a player, and so they asked me to play on what's the bottom board, the worst player on the team. And so I barely knew the rules. I went to play, and I won the game, and there was suddenly validation. Like, all the other kids in the chess team were like, oh, man, that's great, you won. And I felt, like, good about myself. And so I started reading chess books, and I got obsessed, and I started to learn, okay, this is what you do when you have a passion. You read every book you could find. You watch videos if you can. You play or do it as much as you can. You get lessons from professionals. So I took lessons from a guy who was one of the best players in the world when he was younger, another person who became the U.S. chess champion. So I took all these lessons, and very quickly, I got very good because I was taking all these lessons, I was reading all these books, I was playing in every tournament I could play in, and within about a year and a half, I was the junior champion of my state. And that, I didn't become a professional chess player, obviously, but having that on my resume, I think, helped me get into college, grad school, helped me get a bunch of jobs. You know, so there's always different ways. If you get really good at something, anything, there's always ways you could turn it into something useful, either directly or indirectly in your life. You could use it to, for instance, with horseback riding, I'm sure you've used it to make friends. I'm sure you've used it to network with people.
Well, actually, I was just thinking probably my skills of parenting came from training my horse or, you know, with all the animals, because I love animals. So I think that was probably the beginning of my, you know,
your parenting style.
Parenting style.
Well, okay. Right. So tell me an analogy between how you would train a horse and how you'll train a kid.
Well, basically.
And by the way, you're a great mother, and all your kids love you. So, and I've seen the results. So, whatever analogy you say is going to be a great analogy.
Well, it all really comes down to trust, because you know, when training a horse, you really have to get the trust first with that horse, because you become a partner when you're on that horse, and he has to really respect you, and you have to actually let them know, you know, who's in charge. You know, I do let my kids know that. I mean, I did, even now I do, but I've backed off a lot since they've been, you know, now they're young adults, but they have to respect you. And but they know that they can trust me.
So
they know that I would never hurt them. They know that I always have their best interest at heart. So I think a lot of that is just in being consistent.
How do you get the trust of a horse, though, and how does that translate into gaining trust with a kid?
Well, it's just spending time with them. So, you know, I think it's important to spend time with your kids.
So with a horse, when you were younger...
I spent a lot of time with my horse.
Even when you weren't riding?
Right. I would go out there and I'm feeding the horse, so I take care of him. I groom him. I talk to him. It's just funny because he was like my best friend. I mean, I had many horses, but each one of them, they were like my best friend. So they really liked me. You know, sometimes they would get in trouble, you know, because they would bug me off or something.
What do you mean bug you off?
Well, they would kick me off. They would just throw me off.
And then,
so that
okay.
was not fun.
Okay, so when they did that, what did you do? How did you...
They you know, got in trouble. They had time out.
So what does that mean? Like, what would you say? So, what would you do?
Well, that means, well, first I'd have to go catch them because they'd run off because they knew they were in trouble. but I'd take them back to the stable. And so the thing is like, if I couldn't catch them, I couldn't do anything. If they did something, they tried to kick me off or buck me off, I would have to manage it right then and there. I couldn't correct the horse if I caught him down the road, because he wouldn't remember what he did.
Right. So, okay.
Even
let's
with
say,
children are so, like that too. So like, say, if they do something wrong, you've got to correct them right there.
But I'm curious about the horse. Like, so let's say you're sitting on the horse and it does something, you know, it tries to kick you off, but it fails, but it did something bad. What would you do?
Well, each horse was different. So sometimes I would turn him and he'd have to go in a circle just so that I was able to get control over him at that point. So the horses are huge, right? So you have to make sure that you're in control and not them.
So you would like pull back on the reins
and
twist a little?
Oh, I would pull towards myself and I would turn from one with the, yeah, just turn them.
So what's the equivalent with a kid?
So what was what?
What's the equivalent?
Well, the equivalent is having them, you know, stand there, you go down to their level.
And then you beat them.
No, but you know, you just have to... You know, it depends on what age, too. I mean, like when they were really little, of course, I'd have to hold them. They'd cry. I'd have to hold them. They'd want to leave. You can't do that. It's just all different levels of parenting at different times and different situations. Because when they're just walking and children, you know, small, you want them to listen to you. Otherwise, they could run out in the street and get killed. So it was really important.
So like for instance... A kid might, one of your kids might want to just rush out into the street and you say, no, that's bad. And they still try to rush out in the street when you're not looking and then you catch them.
Right. So
what do you do right then?
Well, so what, my kids didn't do that only because I trained them from the time they were walking that if I said no, you know, they it took me a while for them to not do something because they really wanted to keep doing it. But
yeah, so when they disobeyed.
I had to hold on. No, I couldn't trust them to that point. I mean, I'd always hold on to them or, you know, because I knew they were not able to listen. But once they were, you know, I don't know how 5, 6, 7 years old, they could understand. And if something did, I mean, I was always around them, but if they did go towards the street, I would say freeze and they would have to freeze. I mean, they would freeze. So I knew that was a word that I said freeze, they would freeze. And I used that many times.
But if there was probably some times though, very in the beginning where they disobeyed that. And I'm just curious how you trained.
And that would have happened inside a park or inside my home or something, but not, I would have never trusted that to happen in a busy intersection, let's say, you know, because it was too risky.
But how did they learn that freeze, there would be
consequences?
Consequences, yes.
Because there were always consequences if they didn't do it, you know?
Like what a consequence
would be?
With your horse, it was you would pull them back and go in a circle.
Then they would come in, I'd have to put them in timeout, or they wouldn't, depending on their age, they weren't, you know, they had a privilege taken away, they couldn't go to a party, or they, you know, had to stay home inside all weekend, whatever their age appropriate.
So and what's interesting is, because this started off about talking about passions and what happens to them mm-hmm. later on, is that every area you get expertise in, it's special to be an expert in something. You learn things that are beyond what you would learn if you simply, like if you just simply like baseball and like watching baseball games, you never really become, let's say, an expert on baseball. If you don't really study the game, if you don't really, you know, read books or read all the analytics or whatever, you never become an expert. It's okay. You enjoy it throughout life. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you become an expert in anything, it kind of tinges every area of life after that. Like the things you learned by becoming an expert enough to participate in a rodeo, you're able to apply that to your relationships later. Like you mentioned your kid relationships, but I know you apply it to your mm-hmm. husband-wife relationships mm-hmm. as well, this sort of thing. I'm a well-trained husband at this moment. And it's the same thing. Like, again, when I was obsessed with like chess or investing or writing, all of these things, whether I monetize them or not, different things that I learned on the course of becoming an expert or mastering these areas have been incredibly useful to me later in life. You could take anything that I'm sure any of you were interested in when you were younger and see the parallels between that and what you're doing, you know, later on in life. And for instance, you've told me stories about how when you started, you started and owned your own hair salon. You had 70 employees, and a lot of the things you learned about interacting with customers, I mean, I see you apply to this day just in your relationships, like how you talk to people, how you're vulnerable with people, and then they're vulnerable with you. And it's like a natural instinct for you, which I think you probably learned from dealing with customers back then.
Right. No, it's true. I learned so much dealing with the public, and it was just a one-on-one. We were very expensive back then. And, you know, the clients expected a lot. And, but, you know, the situations that occurred during that time.
What's the craziest situation that anyone ever confided in you?
And that's another thing too. You learn, you're like a black hole. So you can hear everything, but you'd never tell that to anybody else.
Until you're on a podcast 20 years later.
And that's where, you know, gossip, you know, we never did that. And that was important, I think, for these people. But I think the craziest things, and this happened more than once, where we would have to book, the husband would call and he wanted to book an appointment for his mistress. But then we knew that the wife was going to be coming in. So we had to make sure, you know, we had a great receptionist. And so she was able to manage all these. Like I said, it happened more than once. So, you know, we just could not put them in the same room or at the same time. And it was pretty interesting.
How many instances of people, either men or women, were of people cheating did you see in a basically a very public-facing social environment company like a hair salon?
I mean, it wasn't super common, but it was common enough that it was like, wow, I can't believe this is going on.
It was basically a function of your business to kind of manage.
Yeah,
one of the functions of your business was to help juggle this for either the men or the women.
Right. No,
was it more men or was it more women?
Men.
Yeah. So, but like women wouldn't come in and confide in you that, I don't know what to do. I'm having this affair. I don't know whether to leave my husband or not.
No.
Wasn't as common.
And most of my clients were women too. And never had that situation.
So again, finding your passion, check out what you're interested in when you're 12, 13, 14 years old and see how it's age through now. Another thing is you can't find out, by the way, you're passionate about something until you do something. So I never was able to see, I'll just use chess as an example. I was never able to say, I'm passionate about getting great at this until I started actually playing games and tournaments and so on. Stand-up comedy, I would never have realized I was passionate about it. I mean, I was always a fan, but I never realized I was passionate about it unless I actually went up on stage a bunch of times and did it. Entrepreneurship, again, I never would have had a passion for it if I didn't try it. It's not like sometimes people say, I want to be an entrepreneur, and they've never done it. They don't realize how hard it is. You have to figure out simple ways to start something, to experiment with something. And that could be the topic of another podcast, how to do these experiments. But you can't think your way to passion. You can't read your way to passion. You have to actually do something to be passionate about it. And that's happened for every instance in my life. And then once you find what you're passionate about, you kind of have to do the passion as much as possible. You have to read about it. You have to study your own mistakes and failures so you can keep improving. You have to get, let's call it a coach or an instructor, so that that person helps you go over your failures and helps you course correct so you can get better and better. And, you know, there's all sorts of skills you have to have. Like, you know, you have to be able to network well. You have to go where other people are doing the passion. You have to figure out how to test yourself and measure your success. You have to figure out what all the micro skills of that passion were. So like, for instance, if you're passionate about business, the micro skills are sales, marketing, ideas, execution, negotiating, and on and on. So you have to get good at all the separate micro skills. And Robin, you were just raising your hand. What did you want to say?
No, but it's interesting because I wrote this down. I think that sometimes what you're good at, like you said, it encourages you because you think, wow, I'm getting all the validation and it feels good. And so That's something that I think with kids, if they're good at something and they want to continue that, as an adult as well. But also being curious, you were always very curious.
You have to be very curious.
I think it's very important to ask questions and to do experiments. I mean, and I'm an entrepreneur. I've always been my whole life. And I think that's part of it is being able to take that risk and to not let something that you're afraid of stop you. I think that's the biggest thing that I could say is, you know, it is scary, but do it, try it.
Even in small ways, like again, how do you construct, like I know a lot of people who have a business idea and what the first thing they want to do is they want to raise a lot of money. They want to hire a bunch of programmers. Mm-hmm. They're going to spend 2 years building the product and then release it. No, I'm 100% sure with every business idea, there's ways to experiment for little to zero money, most likely zero money and in very little time. And you could test out your idea. You could do your idea in some small way. Mm-hmm. I had this conversation with Tony Robbins actually years ago where he told me about a time he was teaching a group of Marines how to shoot better, how to aim more accurately. And he had no idea. He had never shot a gun himself. So he interviewed a bunch of people. First off, he did start shooting and practicing for himself. Then he interviewed a bunch of instructors to learn how they did it. And then what he would do is, in this one group of Marines that they were testing his methods out, he put the target only 1 foot away. So of course, they all hit a bullseye. Then he moved it 2 feet away. Mm-hmm. They all hit a bullseye. Then he moved it 4 feet away. They all hit a bullseye. 8 feet away, bullseye. And finally, you know, all the way against the wall, like 60 feet away, he quickly got them to have the highest scores of any other group being trained through this, bring the target as close as possible. Right. And that's how you can experiment and start getting better in a very non-threatening way. And you can feel that validation. You can get excited about learning. You could learn from your mistakes. You could kind of adjust, you know, oh, I'm leaning too much this way. Right. If that's at 1 foot away, it's going to certainly be at 60 feet away. So I find that analogy to be useful for entrepreneurship or for anything you want to learn. Like if I want to learn to be, let's say, a public speaker, you know, there's ways to try public speaking in, you know, a Friars Club event or some other kind of a public speaking event that's intended for practicing public speaking, or get a group of your friends together and try to teach a little class. You don't even have to call it like talking. So there's, with anything you're doing, there's always ways to experiment rather than say, I can't do that, or listening to the people. Like if I'm interested in sports, it's easy for someone to say, you can't do anything in sports. You're 52 years old and you've never done sports before in your life. Well, maybe there's experiments I can construct that will get me more and more involved in the sports that I'm interested in.
It's all your story. It's all what you believe inside of your head. Really, I mean, you could see somebody or your kids that you're like, oh, they're so amazing and they can do all this stuff. But if they can't see that, their perspective is totally different. They're not going to do it. So it's what movie you're seeing in your mind. So with Tony Robbins, you know, bringing the, you know, for the rifle shooting or whatever, they're seeing themselves successful.
Right.
So, and he's like taking it out further and further. So,
right. If they can do it at 1 foot, there's no reason they can't do it at 2 feet. If they can do it at 2 feet, there's no reason they can do it at 4.
Great. You're right.
Yeah. It's a good technique, but it applies to anything. It applies to chess, business, investing, writing. There's so many ways to practice writing, no matter what, whether you like fiction, nonfiction, writing books, writing stories, writing articles. There's so many ways to practice.
And so I think with kids too, I mean, if you're a parent and you see your kids, you know, doing something that's very good and they are enjoying it, it's maybe something to encourage them or create the space for them to allow to do it. You know what I mean? Allow them to do it.
Well, and I'll give an example with one of your daughters, my stepdaughter, Sarah, okay, who was struggling to find, she kind of was thinking her way to interest. Like maybe she was interested in esports and video games. Maybe she was interested in different types of social media. And then one day we gave her, again, this is a matter of doing versus thinking. We gave her a friend of mine, Wally, Wally Green, who's been on the podcast. He's a great ping pong professional. Wally gave her some ping pong lessons and she was like, you know, and she's slightly on the spectrum and we saw her light up, or I saw her light up in a way that I had never seen her light up
me
before.
Either. Exactly.
And so once an experiment works, you double down on it. So we started giving her weekly, then twice a week, then three times a week ping pong lessons. Now she even works at the ping pong club and she's gotten
it's
great.
Amazing.
Like I've been playing ping pong all my life. She's better than me at ping pong and she's on her way to play in tournaments and it's very exciting for her. And it was a way for her to build a whole social network and subculture that welcomes her and loves her and she loves.
And her self-esteem is just great. I mean, just really amazing.
So sometimes you just have to try lots of things as well. And and I always advise people write down 10 ideas a day. Write down 10 things you may or may not be interested in. Maybe you are, maybe you are. You don't really know yet. And then for each one, the next day, you could write 10 things, 10 ways to experiment with trying this. Like if you're interested in going horseback riding, what are 10, research, what are 10 places you could do horseback riding? Or if you're interested in baseball, what are 10 ways you could take your interest in baseball and pursue it rather than just watching baseball?
Right.
Or if you're interested in business, what are 10 businesses you could start or take an existing business like Google or Amazon. What are 10 ways Amazon can improve their business? Get the idea muscle going. Or for me, if I'm interested in stand-up comedy, what are all the micro skills I need to learn? And then how can I practice each one of them? Or how can I learn to be better at each one of them? Write them down and then start doing them. Anyway, this was an experiment, me telling a story or two about how I found my passion as both as a kid and as an adult. I don't think it's ever too late. You could be 90 years old. I just read an article actually this morning. I didn't tell you this. I read an article about this woman who started doing stand-up comedy at the age of 81 and she's 88 now. And she says people are constantly telling her she can't do it, but she just goes and does it.
Good
she performs all over the city where she lives and people love her. So she created this whole new career at the age of 81. So it's never too late, no matter what you're interested in, to find a passion, to reinvent yourself, and to monetize it. We didn't talk as much about monetizing it, but that could be the subject of another storytelling-based podcast. And if you have any questions, you can find me on Twitter at @JAltucher, or you can find Robin at Twitter at @RAltucher, and ask questions or tell your own story about your passion or ask how to monetize a different passion. We'll address that on a future podcast, but feel free to start asking questions about these things. And also just let us know if you enjoyed this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. And Robin, thanks for...
It was fun. I had fun.
Thanks for joining me. The first time you're on the podcast. I know I interrupted you a lot, but I'll do it less and less in the future. So don't tweet. Stop interrupting your own wife. I know someone's going to tweet that. And Jay, thank you for calling people in their 50s old to kick this off. And thanks for listening.